Welcome, everyone. Good afternoon. I'm Ed Whalen, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. I'm very pleased to welcome you to this event sponsored by the Federalist Society, specifically by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group. The November elections delivered a dramatic transformation of the political landscape. Lambasting an embattled president as incompetent and untrustworthy, what had been a relatively powerless minority party seized control of both houses of Congress, and with that control, the power to launch paralyzing investigations of the administration on sensitive issues and to demand all sorts of confidential documents that might prove embarrassing or worse. But enough about the Republican takeover of Congress in the November 1994 elections and the resulting challenges for the Clinton administration a dozen years ago. In the aftermath of last November's elections and the Democratic takeover of both houses of Congress, we're here today to explore a topic that may gain prominence over these final 2 years of President Bush's second term, namely the clash between Congress's investigative authority and the executive branch's legitimate interest in confidentiality, or, as the program title succinctly puts it, congressional oversight versus executive privilege. To discuss this topic, we're fortunate to have a great panel of experts with experience both in the executive branch and on Capitol Hill. A full accounting of our panelists' credentials will consume most of this session, so let me introduce them briefly in the order in which they'll make their initial presentations. Walter Dellinger heads the appellate practice at the law firm of O'Melveny & Myers and is a distinguished professor of law at Duke University. Walter served as the Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel during President Clinton's first term, both before and after the 1994 Republican takeover. We may hear a fair amount about the Office of Legal Counsel during this discussion because OLC serves as the institutional guardian of executive privilege in the executive branch. After OLC, Walter then headed the Solicitor General's Office. In his prolific academic career, he's written extensively on constitutional issues, and I think it's fair to say that his writings on relations between the executive branch and Congress, at least those written before he served in the executive branch, were favorably received by Congress. Dr. Louis Fisher, to Walter's left, is a specialist in constitutional law with the Law Library of the Library of Congress. He worked for the Congressional Research Service from 1970 to 2006 and wrote major sections of the final report of the House Iran-Contra Committee in 1987. Lou has written well over a dozen books and some 350 articles on constitutional law and Congress. His books include President and Congress, Constitutional Conflicts Between Congress and the President, and The Politics of Executive Privilege. To Lou's left, Doug Cox is a partner with the law firm of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, where his specialties include constitutional law and appellate litigation. Doug worked in the Office of Legal Counsel for 5 years during the administrations of President Reagan and the first President Bush, including as Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General. So Doug's OLC experience covers the last time we had both a Republican president and a Democratic Congress. Chris Bartolomucci is a partner in the law firm of Hogan & Hartson. Chris is at the far left here. And like Walter and Doug, also specializes in issues of constitutional and appellate law. Chris served as Associate White House Counsel for the first 2.5 years of this President Bush's administration. He previously worked as Associate Special Counsel to the Senate Whitewater Committee during, of course, the Clinton administration. Now, to get us going, I'm going to offer some introductory remarks that I hope provide a useful foundation. In case my possible institutional biases are relevant, I'll volunteer that I have experience in both the executive and legislative branches as Principal Deputy in the Office of Legal Counsel from 2001 to 2004 and as a senior Republican staffer to the Senate Judiciary Committee from 1992 to 1995. If you haven't done so already, please quiet your cell phones and any other noisemakers. Also, please know that in addition to C-SPAN's coverage, the Federalist Society will make available on its website the video of this event. Let me first address Congress's so-called oversight authority. It's long been established that Congress has broad investigative authority in support of its general legislative responsibilities. The basic notion is that if Congress is going to be able to legislate wisely, it needs to have access to relevant information. And that includes information in the possession of the executive branch. Congress's authority includes the power to issue subpoenas for witnesses and documents. As a side note, I must say that I find the oversight label unfortunate and confusing in that it seems to suggest that it's Congress's role to oversee or supervise the executive branch when instead the legislative and executive branches are separate and coordinate branches. What is executive privilege? On this 275th anniversary of George Washington's birth, it's worth noting that executive privilege dates back to President Washington. Executive privilege is the concept that there is certain executive branch information that, for the necessary functioning of the executive branch, is presumptively protected from disclosure. As the Supreme Court has ruled, executive privilege is constitutionally based. It inheres in the very nature of executive power and in the president's duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Executive privilege subsumes at least three components: state secrets, law enforcement, and deliberative process. The general interest in keeping confidential, genuine state secrets and certain law enforcement information, such as the status of ongoing criminal investigations, is manifest. The deliberative process component protects decisional deliberations in the executive branch, especially among the president and his advisors, but also including other sensitive decision-making among lower-level officials. The reasons for the deliberative process component, the Supreme Court explained in United States v. Nixon, are plain. Quote, human experience teaches that those who expect public dissemination of their remarks may well temper candor with a concern for appearances and for their own interests to the detriment of the decision-making process. Now, I emphasize again that executive privilege is a presumptive, not an absolute privilege, and it will be accorded different weight in different contexts. That brings us to the context of congressional requests for confidential executive branch information. Here's a typical scenario. A congressional committee requests information from an executive department. The initial request is made informally by a letter, not by a subpoena. Because the request at this point is informal, the executive branch is under no legal obligation to respond. That means that there's no need to invoke executive privilege at this point to protect privileged information. It also means that the responding department is not limited by the scope of executive privilege in determining what materials to provide in response to the request. At this point, the so-called accommodation process is underway. This is a back-and-forth conversation between the requesting committee and the responding department, in which the department, with the advice of OLC, tries to discern what the requesting committee's legitimate interest is and to find ways to satisfy that interest. That may, in the end, involve full compliance with the committee's request, or it might involve agreement on more limited measures, such as making a subset of documents generally available, or having a knowledgeable official provide a briefing, or letting a small number of members of Congress read but not have copies of certain documents. In virtually all instances, the accommodation process yields a result that both sides find acceptable. If it doesn't, the committee's next option is to issue a formal subpoena. Once a subpoena is issued, the president then faces the question of asserting executive privilege to prevent disclosure of disputed documents. Further negotiations might then ensue, and if the committee remains unsatisfied, the next step would be for the full House of Congress to vote to hold the department head in contempt of Congress and then to pursue various enforcement options, including a lawsuit in court to compel compliance with the subpoena. Under D.C. Circuit case law, the committee would have to show that the subpoenaed evidence is, quote, demonstrably critical to the responsible fulfillment of the committee's functions. With that overview, I'm now going to turn it over to the panelists to present their remarks and to dispute or correct anything that I've said. We'll then have some more discussion with some time for your questions at the end. Walter?
The issue of whether material in the possession of the executive branch, records of conversations, internal memorandum, national security memorandum, emails, correspondence, notes of discussions with the president, the issue of whether those materials should be turned over either to the Congress or further disseminated to the public is one of those issues, perhaps rare, where I think the case for each side of the argument is even stronger than is generally assumed. The case for openness in government, the case for the dissemination of material, is the one that is most readily understood and I think is the popular favorite. But even there, I think we understate the case to be made for the sharing of information, because to the extent that information is withheld, To that extent, we are reducing the capacity of the governed to consent to government. The information that is not available to the public means that to that extent, they're unable to judge for themselves the direction that government has made, unable to assess the wisdom or propriety of decisions that have been made by the government when vital information is withheld. So whenever we're expanding executive privilege, we are, to some degree, reducing the scope of government by the people through consent of the governed. And yet I think on the whole, the case for executive privilege is the one that has been undernourished and underappreciated. There are vital interests served by executive privilege, and those interests are recognized across party lines and across administrations and across years. Some of it is about, not just about secrecy, some of it is about which branch of government ought to be controlling certain activities. For example, I think one of the worst kinds of executive privilege requests was one that came in the transition between the first Bush administration and the Clinton administration for all of the records, all of the memorandum by staff attorneys recommending that the government not prosecute certain companies for environmental crimes. These are called declination memos. That the committee that had, committee chair that had authored the criminal environmental statutes thought they were being underenforced and wanted to know why the kind of people that he believed to be the target of his legislation had not been prosecuted, and to find the memos of those trial attorneys doing that. Now, what that does is it intrudes the legislature into the executive process of making criminal law decisions. And this is no mere matter of simple turf war between departments. Because the genius of the American system is to have a double-blind system before the coercive power of government is used. The legislature gets to set the rules that must be obeyed. But they don't know whose ox is going to be gored. And because of the ex post facto clause, they have to legislate prospectively only. The executive branch gets to prosecute. It knows who the parties are, but it doesn't get to set the rules. And once you jump over this line and allow the legislature both to enact the rule and then to try to influence against whom it is invoked, really collapses one of the very essential protections in the American system. It's not proper congressional oversight for Congress to try to oversee and influence how the law is administered. That is an Article II function of the presidency, and it serves powerful interests. Outside the criminal area, I think it is too seldom realized how difficult it is for a president to have the kind of unfettered advice the president needs if the confidentiality of communications among his aides is not respected. If the president is considering option A and option B, and you want to make the case against option B, and you're the deputy White House counsel, you want to write as strong a memo as you can write saying, here is why option B is hugely flawed and may even raise serious legal problems. But the president, in his wisdom, chooses option A. Now, he chooses option B that you've been assailed by the memo writer. Now, both in litigation and in debate, the memo becomes public. It's crippling. The president's own advisor said this, and this about it, which may be fine to shape the debate on that issue. But what happens the next time the president's considering option A and option B? Who wants to write the memo that may be public that critiques the choice the president ultimately makes? And that means that presidents no longer get the kind of unfettered advice that they need. And the legitimacy of those concerns has to be recognized over time. It's interesting to see the various historical patterns. As I looked through, ran through the Office of Legal Counsel executive privilege opinions, I noted that they're bunched in periods of time when the opposition party takes over Congress, as Ed Whalen noted, that for the first 2 years of President Clinton's administration, there are no OLC executive privilege memoranda to speak of. And then starting with the takeover of Congress in 1995, it seemed like that's all one was doing was executive privilege memoranda. And I thought coming in, it is very important for every president and those who serve that president to recognize the importance of maintaining the essential integrity of the president's powers. My party had been for virtually 20 years the party of Congress, and the other party for almost all of the 20 years had been the party of the executive branch. And each political party had its own branch of government. Congressional Democrats, hegemonic presidential Republicans. And there was legitimate concern, I think, among many who had been in the Office of Legal Counsel fraternity that when the party of Congress took over the executive branch, that OLC would badly weaken the protections because they were so influenced by Congress. But I thought it very important, and for 2 years had to suffer internal criticisms to uphold with the legitimate authority of the president. When we're defending our presidents, it's interesting to watch the patterns of citation in these opinions. Our memoranda tend to cite Assistant Attorney General Rehnquist and Assistant Attorney General Ted Olson. I notice in this administration they tend to cite Assistant Attorney General Walter Dellinger for the propositions, which is as it should be, I think, that each is trying to exemplify this. Seldom cited are the opinions of Assistant Attorney General Scalia. And that is interesting because they are not the bold, full-bodied defense of executive privilege you would expect from the author of the dissenting opinion in Morrison against Olson. And that, I am told by the former Assistant Attorney General, is partly the administration which he served. The Ford administration came in under the shadow of Watergate, where every assertion of executive privilege, the term was considered to be Latin for cover-up. In that era, so that the Ford administration was not inclined to be very strong in defense. So you have to look back to the opinions of Attorney General Rehnquist or forward to those of in later administrations of Assistant Attorney General Bill Barr, et cetera, to find the relatively weak ones are from the Carter era and the Ford era in terms of the protection of executive power. But beyond that, there is a very strong consensus, and I will simply say that I think it's very important for all of us to recognize while it does reduce the information available to the public, and that is to be taken seriously, that every president has the responsibility to turn the office over to his successors with its essential attributes unimpaired. And I do not think you can have an effective functioning presidency without an effective principle of executive privilege. This is a country that has had strong executive leadership and as a result has settled a vast continent, won the Civil War, ended slavery, turned back the tide of fascism in Europe, combated the worst economic depression the world has ever seen, and won the Cold War. That's no small list of achievements in a country that has had a strong executive, and executive privilege, I think, will continue to be an important part of that.
Good afternoon. If you look at these contests, Congress trying to get information or Congress trying to get someone to testify and the executive branch resisting, my guess is that 95-98% of them are settled along political grounds. Each side might cite a court case or language, but that language from a court case is not likely to be how you resolve the issue. So important legal and constitutional issues are at stake, but in the end, it comes down to how much Congress wants the information, how much they intend that someone testify, and turns very much on how much pain the executive branch wants to suffer before it settles. As Walter suggested, on these conflicts, both sides have reasonable grounds. This don't make things up out of the air. When you look at the executive branch may resist by saying you can't have this because it's part of the deliberative process, or you can't have this because it has something to do with active litigation files. When I look at these struggles, I see it as more like opening arguments, and no, the Congress should not take them that seriously. They're opening, not closing arguments. So to give you an example of how it can work, in 1986, President Reagan nominated William Rehnquist to go from Associate Justice up to Chief Justice. And the Senate Judiciary Committee, as part of its confirmation process, wanted certain memos that Rehnquist wrote when he headed OLC. And you can imagine what the executive branch said. We cannot release these memos. They're part of our process. They're part of the kind of candor a president needs in getting advice from executive officials. The problem was that the committee had quite a big card to play, and it looked as though there was a bipartisan support for a subpoena to get those OLC documents. And it wasn't just Rehnquist's nomination that was at stake. The Senate planned to vote on both Rehnquist for Chief Justice and Scalia for Associate Justice on the same day. So you had two nominations held up with this dispute. And the committee made a very credible position that unless we get the memos, the name doesn't come out of committee. It will not go to the floor. So at that point, that's a pretty credible card, and you go and do whatever kind of accommodation is necessary. I'm always surprised when I see these disputes, what I regard as really lame arguments will initially be made by the executive branch. For example, the executive branch will say you can't have those because it's covered by Exemption 3, Exemption 5, or something rather for you. And these are things coming out of the General Counsel's office, and then Congress has to say that FOIA applies to the public access, it doesn't apply to congressional access, and there's language in FOIA to that effect. There's another one similar to that, that one agency didn't want to give information to a committee of jurisdiction because the statute specifically said that this kind of information shall be protected from disclosure. Of course, it was disclosure to the public, not to the committees of jurisdiction. And Congress actually had to go back and take that statute and revise it so that the statute cannot be used in the future for that kind of argument. I think a lot of you followed the statute from 1789, the so-called housekeeping statute, which was simply meant that each agency is responsible for its custodian of the documents. It was never meant to, as an authority to withhold documents, particularly documents in litigation. Congress finally in 1958 amended the housekeeping statute. Now, I think today you'll hear the argument that it makes a difference whether Congress is asking for information for legislative purposes or whether it's asking for oversight purposes. And if it's the latter, Congress has a weaker argument. So 1981, the first time I saw this argument, Attorney General William French Smith issued an opinion stating that when Congress issues a subpoena as part of a, quote, legislative oversight inquiry, access by Congress has less justification than when it seeks information for legislative purposes. I don't think it's a sound argument. If Congress is asking for information as part of the impeachment process, has nothing to do with legislation. I think presidents have routinely and regularly said that the doors are pretty much open. Can't think of many arguments that you would withhold from Congress information needed as part of an impeachment non-legislative process. It's also not a sound argument because if there was anything to it, and I don't think there is, it means that every time you're doing oversight, you just introduce a bill. It's very easy to do, and then you pretend that it's legislative. So we'll talk about that. I said that case law isn't very helpful in this area, but of course we'll all quote from a court case. And Eastland case in 1975 In terms of how focused the congressional inquiry has to be, do you have to have legislation in mind? Is that the goal of it? Anything short of that is not legitimate. And the Eastland case, the court said that, quote, the very nature of the investigative function, like any research, is that it takes the searchers up some blind alleys and into nonproductive enterprises. To be a valid legislative inquiry, there need be no predictable end results. There doesn't have to be legislation in mind for Congress, particularly the committees of jurisdiction, to do its work. Scalia has been mentioned. One of the quotes I like very much from him when he headed OLC, he testified in 1975 before a Senate subcommittee. And in my book on the politics of executive privilege, I put this in the concluding section, Scalia. He told the committee that when congressional and presidential interests collide, the answer is likely to be in, Scalia is a wonderful writer, likely to be in, quote, the hurly-burly, the give and take of the political process between the legislative and the executive. When it comes to an impasse, the Congress has means at its disposal to have its will prevail. And I think that's true. If Congress really wants in and is willing to go not just to subpoenas but to holding people in contempt, usually just the move toward contempt or reporting it out, you don't need even any floor action on it. But that, I'll conclude with this, depends on whether Congress sees itself as a separate branch. And the Federal Society, with Madison always in the background, Madison assumed that each branch would have a understanding of itself and would fight off encroachments, and therefore whatever in text we do in separating powers would be kept alive through this battle, fighting off any kind of incursions. And to me, for about the last 50 years, not just the last 6-7 years, the last 50 years, Congress has less and less understanding of itself as a separate branch of its duties on why structure. You know, Justice Kennedy emphasizes this all the time, that rights and liberties are not protected fundamentally by courts, they're protected by structure. The framers believe that. That's what I believe in. You can, very little is going to come through the courts, so you expect the branches to fight each other so that power doesn't get concentrated and abused. And I did a book in the year 2000. It's called Congressional Abdication of War and Spending. So those are, you can't get more fundamental on prerogatives than war and spending. And Congress, it's amazing how many members of Congress will take the president as a leader, not just on war powers, but all of foreign affairs. I did a piece in Legal Times a month or two ago about the awful sole organ doctrine in the Curtis Wright case. What has to be one of the worst arguments in history, but is quoted all the time. The president's sole organ in external affairs. John Marshall never meant that. So that, what can be done to have members of Congress appreciate their own body and recognize their duty in taking an oath of office to support not the president, but to support the Constitution? I think it's all in our interest for Congress to wake up. Thank you.
Doug?
Thank you. I agree with much of what we've just heard. I agree with Walter that the executive branch does have a bona fide interest in confidentiality. I would agree with Lou that over the years, accommodation has historically worked to resolve conflicts in this area. But all this high-minded agreement is not only boring, but is also a little misleading. It overlooks the fact that much oversight is bad, unjustified, and political. To take just one example mentioned by Lou, it's nice that the Senate and President Reagan agreed over Chief Justice Rehnquist's nomination. But if you believe that the original Senate request was an unjustified intrusion into executive branch decision-making, and that future executive branch officials will be chilled by this type of disclosure, the way Walter described, the resulting compromise is not something we should necessarily applaud. I'm going to begin by highlighting a few quick points about executive privilege. I am delighted that even though I'm going third, all of the platitudes have not yet been said, and I want to get a few of them out on the table. I'm then going to talk briefly about good and bad oversight, and then I'm going to mention some of the many innovations in executive privilege practice and doctrine that arose during the Clinton administration. My quick preliminary points are, as we've already heard, both Congress and the executive branch have legitimate interests in these disputes. Our view as to the legitimacy of those interests and the legitimacy of devices to protect those interests should not change with shifts of party power. Put in terms of cliche, where we stand should not depend on where we sit. Because we've had several recent changes of party control in the White House and in Congress, both parties and both branches have had opportunities to make mistakes and to overreach. And unfortunately, both parties have made the most of those opportunities. Relatedly, both parties have an obligation to understand that in a realm with very few judicial decisions, their conduct and practice will form key precedents for future disputes. Just the way we look back to President Washington, future presidents are going to look to President Clinton and President Bush. Thus, excess of aggression or excess of cooperation will come back to haunt future presidents and future Congresses. Given separation of powers concerns, oversight can readily turn into a constitutional conflict. Both sides need to work to keep that from happening. Finally, it bears noting that oversight takes many forms. It is not just the full-blown hearing covered by C-SPAN. Letters and telephone calls to executive branch personnel, reports required by legislation, requests for documents, and other devices are all forms of oversight. Now, Walter emphasized the president's need for confidentiality. Let me emphasize the congressional interest in oversight. As Ed mentioned, there's no explicit constitutional textual grant of oversight power to Congress, but it has been understood since the very earliest days that oversight is part of the congressional function. The text does give us some help. Again, that Lou mentioned this, that there's the reference to the power to legislate, to appropriate, and to impeach. And the Supreme Court has said that Congress, when it is pursuing these legitimate constitutional activities, does have a legitimate interest in information from the executive branch. Oversight is necessary to know how existing laws are working, to see how they should be amended or supplemented or repealed. It's necessary to see how the public's money is being spent. Oversight, of course, can be bad. It can be done sloppily, with no preparation and no follow-through. It can be done for bad reasons. It can be characterized by leaks and abuse. But oversight can also be good. Indeed, when performed properly, oversight can be a very good thing for everyone. It can lead, for example, to more informed legislation, legislation that works better. Significantly, Congress can summon to come and testify experts from the country and from the world at large to provide their own insights. And that's one thing that Congress can do that courts can't do. It's one of the reasons why a lot of decisions should be made in Congress and not in courts, because Congress can get more information than just what is put before it by the parties. Congress, when it conducts oversight, can produce less draconian legislation when it has a more fixed and appropriate understanding of the problem it wishes to address. It can come up with a more narrowly tailored statute. Oversight can also lead to less legislation. It is not inconceivable that Congress would someday find a problem that does not need federal legislation as a response. There's also the fact that oversight can be a way for the executive branch to help itself. Congress, indeed, may have insight or guidance that actually helps improve policy formation and the execution of the laws, and the executive branch should be ready to receive that guidance. Or if that sounds excessively naive, oversight can help the executive branch by giving it an opportunity to tell its story or even to get Congress on the hook. When things go very wrong with an executive branch program, it is a big relief and a big political benefit to be able to say, we told Congress what we were doing months ago. Now, there are limits on congressional oversight. I've already mentioned that it must be in aid of a legitimate congressional activity. More specifically, Congress may not use oversight power to control the execution of the laws.
Walter mentioned one of the core examples of that principle, the execution of the laws with respect to prosecutorial discretion. Congress may also not use oversight to change policy in the executive branch as opposed to changing the law. I believe it's the same William French Smith opinion that Lou quoted and criticized that I quote and applaud when the Attorney General said, when oversight is used as a means of participating directly in an ongoing process of decision-making within the executive branch, it oversteps the bounds of proper legislative function. Congress also cannot inquire into powers that belong exclusively to the president, such as the appointment power and the power to recognize foreign nations. Now, Ed mentioned that, of course, the 2006 elections have changed the alignment on Capitol Hill. And for insight into what the future is likely to hold for Congress and the Bush administration, we can look back to the Clinton administration. President Clinton asserted executive privilege far more times and over far more documents than his predecessors. For example, he asserted the privilege more often than his three immediate predecessors combined. In the Travelgate dispute alone, I know this is kind of a walk down memory lane, but in Travelgate alone, he asserted the privilege over 2,000 pages of documents, literally 1,000 times the number of pages that President George H.W. Bush sought to protect by executive privilege in his entire presidency. But this is not all. President Clinton was more aggressive about executive privilege in at least three other ways as well. First, he has sought to assert the privilege in the context of criminal investigations, most notably in the Starr investigation. And that's one of the things that's remarkable about the Clinton administration is that many of the executive privilege fights didn't take place vis-a-vis Congress, but rather vis-a-vis the independent counsel. And with the end of the independent counsel statute, we won't necessarily see these precise fights again. But prior presidents had taken the position that in the face of well-founded allegations of criminal misconduct by their administration, they would not assert the privilege, and indeed President Reagan is the classic example. He waived the privilege in its entirety at the start of the Iran-Contra investigation. That wasn't President Clinton's approach. Second, President Clinton argued in court successfully that presidential communications are presumptively privileged even if the matters discussed involved privileged conduct. Involved private conduct. Prior to the Clinton administration, most commentators believed that executive privilege only extended to the president's official conduct. And Lou, you mentioned you weren't aware of an instance in which anyone had asserted executive privilege in the context of impeachment. This is an instance. In fact, President Clinton's argument in court was that these conversations about his private conduct had to be kept confidential because they might lead to his impeachment. Third, President Clinton adopted the practice of asserting executive privilege over documents en masse, as the Travelgate 2,000-page document precedent shows. The administration called it a protective assertion of the privilege pending further review, but no prior president ever sought to assert the privilege over so many documents without reviewing them or over such a large number of documents at one time. That en masse assertion had some embarrassing consequences. For example, included in the documents over which the White House asserted privilege in Travelgate was a document prepared by a lawyer in the White House counsel's office consisting of notes to herself. That sounds very promising. Sounds like a likely candidate for the privilege. Except the notes were about the lawyer's appointment to have her legs waxed. It's not traditionally viewed as an appropriate subject for executive privilege. And the Travelgate assertion flirts with yet a fourth innovation, permitting someone other than the president to assert executive privilege. One of the restraints on executive privilege, of course, is the enormous political cost ever since the Nixon administration that goes with the assertion. And obviously, president of any party would be delighted if that power, that burden could be put elsewhere. But traditionally, assertions of executive privilege have been viewed as things that the president must do personally, like signing bills. But in May of 1996, Attorney General Reno signed an opinion basically saying that she was asserting the privilege, to be sure, provisionally, and pending a further decision by the president, but asserting the privilege provisionally and putting off to another day the day when the president would have to decide whether or not to assert the privilege. Now, the Bush White House might be tempted to plumb the remarkable world of the Clinton precedents, but at least a few of those presidents are extreme. Perhaps the Clinton administration believed that extreme responses were justified by an extremist Congress. But in any event, the executive privilege disputes of the Clinton years, in addition to being distorted by the existence of an independent counsel, were quite corrosive and not a high point for interbranch comity. Instead, the executive branch should respect legitimate congressional oversight, participate in the process, and not seek to turn it into a scorched battlefield. For its part, Congress should resist the temptation to engage in bad oversight, even though it has seen bad oversight done before, and even though the administration might be perceived as highly vulnerable. Congress can respect the constitutional limits, respect the executive branch's interests, and still perform effective oversight. As Lou says, and I agree, Congress and the executive branch have a duty to accommodate one another. The interests of the two branches are sufficiently divergent as to guarantee some friction, but they need not lead to conflict. As Lou says, and I agree, within the established accommodation framework, the legitimate interests of both Congress and the executive branch can be served. Thank you.
Good afternoon. As Ed mentioned, I've worked on both sides of the oversight privilege debate, having served on both the Senate Whitewater Committee and in the first term of the current Bush administration in the White House Counsel's Office. And what I'd like to do today is discuss three matters in which I was involved or close to, and then use those as a springboard for observations about oversight and privilege. The first matter I want to talk about is the showdown between the Senate Whitewater Committee and the Clinton White House over notes taken by a then associate White House counsel named William Kennedy. In the fall of 1993, back when some people cared about the Whitewater matter, or at least could remember it, the Resolution Trust Corporation had issued a number of criminal referrals relating to the Madison Guaranty Savings and Loan and Whitewater Development Corporation. And these criminal referrals also made some reference to the Clintons. The White House Counsel's Office was given a heads up about these supposedly confidential referrals by various agency officials. So one of the charges of the Senate Whitewater Committee was to investigate whether the White House, including members of the White House Counsel's Office, improperly handled that confidential information. Now, on November 5th of 1993, a meeting was held at the private law firm that was acting as the president's legal counsel, and there were several private lawyers in attendance, as well as several White House counsel's lawyers. One of the attendees, associate counsel William Kennedy, took notes. The special committee issued a subpoena for those notes, which Bill Kennedy, on instruction, refused to produce. The White House and the president's private lawyers asserted that these notes were covered by both the attorney-client privilege and the work product doctrine. Interestingly, the White House did not assert that the notes were covered by executive privilege, or at least not executive privilege, qua executive privilege. The Whitewater Committee, being, of course, having a majority of Republican members, overruled these objections to their subpoena. And the full Senate, after some floor debate, voted. They have a procedure that they invoked where they voted the Senate Legal Counsel to initiate a civil action in district court to compel Mr. Kennedy to produce the notes. And at that point, rather than go to court to fight over the notes any further, the White House relented and produced the notes. Three lessons from this episode. Number one, when the Congress and the White House face off over documents, the deck truly is stacked against the White House, both as a political and a public relations matter. Even if an assertion of privilege is valid, and even if the documents in question contain nothing damaging, the refusal to produce the documents can easily lead to allegations of stonewalling or perhaps even a cover-up, and few presidents are willing to stand on principle in the face of such adverse publicity. Second, Second lesson, even the mere assertion of executive privilege comes at a political cost. As Walter discussed, the very term executive privilege sounds Nixonian and conjures up images of Watergate. So in the Whitewater matter, the White House didn't even want to assert that the notes in question were covered by executive privilege. And final lesson, this is an example and a fairly common example of accommodation. This particular type of accommodation is not that uncommon, in which the White House pushes back for a while and then completely surrenders. In the end, the White House decided that it was better to release the documents than to prolong the fight through protracted court litigation. The second matter I want to discuss is involves the Presidential Records Act and President Bush's Executive Order 13-233. The Presidential Records Act, or PRA, is a post-Watergate statute that requires the President and White House staff to preserve presidential records, including documents that are used to assist the President. When the President leaves office, the archivist of the United States becomes responsible for preserving and controlling access to these records. Under the PRA, a president can restrict access for up to 12 years to certain presidential records, including classified national security materials, confidential communications between the president and his advisors, and files containing private personal information. But after the 12 years are up, the records become generally available to the public. Well, this matter came to a head early on in the Bush administration because the first records to which the act applied, the Reagan records, had their 12-year period expire in January of 2001. So enter President Bush's Executive Order 13-233, which he issued on November 1, 2001. The order was necessary because, as the PRA itself recognizes, the president possesses certain constitutionally based privileges, and the PRA itself does not address, or at least not fully, how assertions of such privilege should be handled and resolved. Of course, the Act did not purport to limit those constitutional privileges and could not have done so as a statute. So the specific purpose of the President's executive order was to establish procedures for implementing the PRA with respect to those constitutionally based privileges, consistent with both the PRA and what the Supreme Court had said about those privileges in case law. The executive order starts off by recognizing that the constitutionally based privileges of the president include the state secrets privilege, the presidential communications privilege, the attorney-client privilege, and the deliberative process privilege. It's interesting that the order nowhere uses the term executive privilege. It always uses the term constitutionally based privileges. I think this is another instinctual aversion to that particular term. The order also recognizes that the constitutionally based privileges of the president extend beyond the president's term of office and may in fact be asserted by a former president with respect to his administration's records after he leaves office. Now to the meat of the order. The order provides that when the archivist receives a request for presidential records, the archivist is to notify both the incumbent president and the former president during whose administration the records were created. If either the incumbent president or the former president asks to the archivist to withhold a record on the basis of privilege, the archivist is then required to deny access unless a court orders the release. The order broke new ground in two important ways. First, under the order, the former presidents may assert privilege as to their records, and incumbent presidents may also assert privilege as to a former president's records. This has been criticized as being unduly restrictive in terms of public access to important documents. But in the Nixon versus Administrator of General Services case, the Supreme Court indicated that the presidential privileges survive the individual president's tenure, and it rejected the specific argument that only an incumbent president can assert the privilege of the presidency. So what the order does would seem to be consistent with the Supreme Court's Nixon case. The second important feature of the executive order is that, unlike the PRA, which seemed to assume that if a president thought a document was privileged, he would have to go to court to prevent the release of a document. The executive order places the burden on the party seeking the documents to go to court when a privilege is asserted. Now, this shifting of the burden has also been criticized, but it is consistent with the FOIA model, under which when an agency asserts a FOIA exemption, the burden then is upon the party seeking the document to go to court to initiate litigation in an attempt to overcome the asserted privilege. The approach of the executive order is also consistent with what the Supreme Court said in United States versus Nixon, where it said that in order to overcome a presidential privilege, the party seeking the records must establish a demonstrated specific need for the records in question. The third and last topic I want to turn to is the subpoena issued to the Bush White House in May of 2002 by the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee, at the time chaired by Senator Lieberman. This was actually the first subpoena from the Congress that the Bush White House had received, and it was a subpoena that sought to obtain a wide variety of records relating to Enron. Of course, Ken Lay's ties to the Bush administration were well known, and the suspicion was out there that Enron in its dying days may have reached out to the Bush administration for help, and there were questions about what the Bush administration might have done in terms of intervening to try to save Enron. So the Lieberman subpoena broadly sought all documents relating communications between the executive office of the president and Enron, or between the executive office of the president and other federal agencies regarding Enron. Ultimately, the Bush administration turned over 2,000 pages of documents relating to Enron. It did not assert executive privilege in the matter. A few observations about this episode. Number one, with this kind of oversight, that is the issuance of a subpoena, Congress can impose significant burdens on the executive at very little cost to itself. It imposes almost no burden on the Congress to issue a subpoena, yet at the White House, it's very time-consuming to respond to a subpoena and diverts attention from other matters. In this particular case, the subpoena consumed much of the time of the counsel to the president and his deputy counsel, and as well as several associate counsels. Furthermore, responding to subpoenas in the White House is a real challenge. In the corporate world, of course, we are familiar with document retention policies, which really means they're document destruction policies. Well, there's no such thing in the White House. Because of the Presidential Records Act, almost every document in the White House gets saved. When a staff member leaves the White House, he or she has to turn over all of her records to the Office of Records Management. All the email is saved. So there are a lot of records to be found and searched. There are also a lot of places within the White House where you have to look for records. The Executive Office of the President is actually a very large organization that encompasses a lot more than what you might think as West Wing decision makers. The EOP includes such entities as the Office of Science and Technology Policy, the Office of National Drug Control Policy, and the Enron subpoenas required the White House to search all of these organizations for records, even though it was highly unlikely that Ken Lay was going to call the drug czar for any reason. Second point, responding to congressional subpoenas creates a real dilemma in the first instance for the White House. One school of thought, and perhaps even the conventional wisdom, is that you should just immediately disclose everything. We all know that the cover-up is always worse than the underlying matter, and what you should do is just release every document right away. And that is certainly a very good strategy if you're quite confident that there's nothing sensitive or damaging in the documents. But quite often, you might have no idea what what the documents may actually reflect. So then the thinking becomes, well, maybe we ought to, you know, gather them first and take a look before we decide what we should do with them. But this approach is also problematic because once you decide to conduct an internal investigation, gather the documents, review them, and come up with an explanation for what happened, you always run the risk that the congressional overseers will decide to investigate the investigation. So even if you're not in trouble for the underlying documents, you might get yourself in trouble for your own investigation of them. In the Enron matter, the Bush White House took kind of a middle path, and it interviewed key people who would have been most likely to have contacts related to Enron, and the administration tried to turn over that information to the Congress, but that proved to be insufficient. The Senate insisted on receiving all the documents it requested, and as in the case of the Whitewater matter, the White House eventually relented and turned over everything that was asked for. Final lesson is that it is very hard for the White House to win a fight over documents. There really is no upside to responding to document requests. If you refuse or you misstep, you get excoriated. If, as in this case, you turn over all the documents and there is no smoking gun, that goes largely unnoticed. The press rarely writes stories in the vein of smoking gun not found. With that, I will I'll sit down and we can move to the questioning.
Thanks very much, everyone. I'd like to have some discussion among the panelists first. But if I may, I'd like to first briefly respond to Lou Fisher, who kindly took me up on my invitation to dispute my remarks. And I just want to clarify, Lou, that I do not disagree with anything you said about the scope of Congress's proper investigative authority. I think that investigative authority is very broad. I'm not saying it requires any legislation to be pending. My point is a semantic one obviously rejected by most members of this panel. I find the term oversight confusing and misleading, but I don't think that point affects anything you had to say about the proper breadth of congressional investigation. With that said, if any panelists would like to respond to any other, please, Lou.
Yeah, just something Doug Cox said, that oversight shouldn't interfere with the execution of law. Seems like a good principle, but it happens every day of the week, and I think for pretty good reasons. Most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the Chadha case in 1983 where the Supreme Court struck down the legislative veto. The year before the court decided the case, I wrote a long article for Washington Post saying that it doesn't matter what the court says, these are going to continue because they've been in place for decades and a very nice accommodation, particularly where agencies estimate the budget way down before they know what's going to happen in the fiscal year and things happen and they want to shift money around inside an appropriation account. It's called reprogramming. So there was this arrangement that if you do certain kinds of shifting of money, just notify the committees of jurisdiction. If other types, and we'll tell you what they are, you come back and get committee approval, and that's usually subcommittee approval and appropriations. So this is, if you don't like legislative vetoes, one house or two house, you certainly don't like committee and subcommittee vetoes, but they've always continued after charter. And the reason they continue is not because Congress thumbs its nose at the Supreme Court. Congress is quite willing to comply with charter, but the executive branch wouldn't like it because President Reagan in 1984 saw a lot of these committee vetoes in a bill and said, we don't treat them as binding. We just you don't have to get approval from committees, just notification. And House Appropriations says, fine. In the future, whenever you want to have this little discretion that you've had in the past, you get yourself what Chadha said. You go through bicameralism and you go through presentment. You get yourself another public law. So that's why Congress does get involved in execution of the law. And there are very sound reasons. And the alternative isn't good for anybody.
Doug, did you have?
I would like to respond. I think it was Doug, maybe both, about overclaiming or a fairly aggressive use of executive privilege in the Clinton administration. Let me begin by saying, first of all, that a president can weaken the office for his successors either by underclaiming executive privilege or other prerogatives, or by overclaiming and bringing in, therefore, into disrepute the legitimate uses of those claims. In the early months, one of the issues in the Clinton administration was not having an attorney general, and then there was no confirmed head of OLC for 9 months after the administration took office, because the senior senator from North Carolina did not take kindly to a fellow North Carolinian's office aspirations, and so there was some delay in my confirmation. And I think, though it's apart from our subject, it's very important for a president to get his legal advice from the Department of Justice and not from inside the White House. The Department of Justice has an institutional history. It has people like Paul Colburn, who's been here today, who have done executive privilege work for administrations of different parties. There's a sense of continuity in the Justice Department. But I think when you make those decisions inside the White House without the sufficient distance and somewhat greater disinterestedness and career lawyer aspect of the Department of Justice, you can make mistakes. I think that the nadir of all of these charges, the White House travel office, was a very serious matter. Not the firing, which was clearly legal, but the fact that the FBI put out a statement suggesting that a number of employees of that office were under criminal investigation when they were not, and the role of the White House in influencing. That was a very serious matter. And a claim of 2,000 pages of privilege about that matter, I was not involved in reviewing it, does raise one's eyebrows and initially gets you off to a start of a situation which people may think that you are overclaiming executive privilege, and that is to be... that is to be regretted, and is why every president needs to be careful with it. Claiming attorney-client privilege as against Congress strikes me as generally dubious. The client of every person in the government, every lawyer in the government's client, is the United States of America. And the United States does have attorney-client privilege with respect to outsiders who are suing the government. But within the government of the United States, it has always struck me as odd that within the client group itself you claim something called attorney-client privilege, which was done in the Clinton administration and perhaps subsequent to that, to avoid using the term executive privilege. There was a time when executive privilege was more honored, just letting me note, than it is now, when it was not a term of opprobrium. Remember that President Washington, when a congressional investigation into the failure of the General St. Clair's expedition, wanted all of the papers pertaining to that, Washington asked his cabinet, knowing that it would be an important precedent. And their answer was, quote, that the executive ought to communicate such papers as the public good would permit and ought to refuse those, the disclosure of which would injure the public. And that position was agreed to not only by President Washington, but by James Madison, Edmund Randolph, and Alexander Hamilton. And in the era of President Eisenhower, when he ordered all employees of the government not to turn over any documents whatsoever to the subcommittee of the Senate Committee on Government Operations, known as the Joseph McCarthy Committee, he was hailed as a hero by the press that later was to take a dimmer view of executive privilege.
Well, if there's no other cross comments from panelists, Art Luda, you have something you want to say?
No.
Okay, well, let me pose a question, which is raised in part by the Eisenhower invocation that you cite, Walter. I'd be interested in the panelists' views as to the scope of officials, executive branch employees, who are covered by the deliberative process component. Again, at its core, I think everyone agrees, and Supreme Court case law recognizes, are communications between the president and his advisors. But how broadly does this deliberative process component spread? Any thoughts on that? Doug?
Well, we have gotten some guidance
recently on that issue. As Ed mentions, the Supreme Court case, U.S. versus Nixon, said it extended to the president and his circle of advisors. I think people who had been advising administration since that decision had always thought, as a matter of logic, that the circle of covered people had to be broader than just the advisors. It had to go out to people who conferred in order to advise them. And indeed, in one of the cases in the 90s, the D.C. Circuit ruled that the privilege did extend to people in sort of the outer circle of advisors, people who were preparing to advise other advisors to the president. And so it extends to conversations in which the president does not participate and in which he is not even in some proximate sense a recipient of the advice coming out of the conversation.
I'd like to speak to the practicalities of this. The president does not delegate his authority. The presidential power is exercised personally. So the president has to make countless decisions and, therefore, will have very little time to spend debating a large number of those decisions. Yet his staff may spend weeks and weeks deciding what course of action to recommend to the president. So for a large number of matters, the real back and forth and deliberative process occurs out of the presence of the president, but between his senior advisors and mid-level advisors. And then they might meet with the president only for a few minutes in order to recommend what the decision ought to be. And so if the privilege were restricted only to the 2 minutes that you spend talking to the president, it really would be quite meaningless.
Let me add this thought. Chris Bartolomeucci spoke of the burden that executive privilege requests put on the executive branch, on the White House in particular, and how it is not multilateral. That is, you can't make similar requests of the Senate. And I hope we don't see that forthcoming in the next 2 years, because when you have the opposition power in control of the committees of Congress and therefore in control of the subpoena power, it can be enormously damaging and destructive to your ability to get anything coherent done on your job. For example, one of the requests that came from one of the House committees was, first of all, a broad request for documents about some issue, but then 6 weeks later, a request for every note, every document, every phone log relating to any discussions in any way related to the response to the previous congressional subpoena, so that you can't think. And I had the feeling when I decided not to be considered for the position of White House counsel at one point that it ought to be one's last job, because there's a sense that you're under intense pressure. If you make a mistake in terms of not turning over documents, your own personal culpability is at stake. There are fewer rules in the White House than there are it doesn't have the security of the Department of Justice, which has its traditions and where you can make every decision by drawing upon the advice of career attorneys, to give you a sense that you're not off base. But I think we've made the White House a very difficult place to think, to plan, and to work. And that's the last thing we want to do in any political configuration, is to hamper the process of effective decision making. You may want to oppose the decisions that are made, but you don't want to hamper the process by which clear thinking is done.
Lou?
Yeah. On the deliberative process, 2 points. I think, Ed, you mentioned that in the Iran-Contra that executive privilege was waived entirely. Someone did. And it was quite remarkable, because there was a lot of discomfort in the Reagan administration that what was done was impeachable, and the solution was to throw it all out there. So working on the Iran-Contra committee is amazing to see Secretary of State Shultz and Secretary of Defense Weinberger and others come in and say, well, what did you say to the president, and what did he say back? And it was all out there. So that was a quite extraordinary time. More recently, if you remember, on the 9/11 commission, which was created by statute, they wanted Condi Rice, National Security Advisor, to come up. And there was a written statement by White House Counsel Gonzalez that no constitutional principles prohibited separation of powers. She's a White House official, White House And I knew in the past there have been plenty of White House people who have come up to committees. And I was just waiting, reading Gonzalez's memo, how many days this is going to last before that's going to be dropped. And I think it was about 2 days, and there's another Gonzalez memo saying that she can come and she can testify, but this doesn't create a precedent. Well, they're out there. And there's, depending on what you do in the White House, if you are purely advisory, once you get into policymaking, which White House people are more and more inclined, then you're getting more like an executive agency. And you also, I think it's a weak argument because Condi Rice and others are on TV. They're out in the public giving talks, talking about things. And if they can do that, what's the harm of them coming before a congressional committee? Any cabinet head can tell a committee that I can't get into that for various reasons of privilege, so anyone can do that in committee. So I think the nature of the White House is so changed that its privilege over immunity is losing ground.
Walter, your comments about opposing policy instead of hampering it through requests, burdensome requests, seems a very sound one, especially in a time of war. Let me ask the panelists, what, looking into your crystal balls or playing committee chairman, if you like, what do you foresee as the likely focuses, if any, of congressional requests for sensitive information over these next 2 years?
Well, Walter and I testified a couple of weeks ago before Senate Judiciary just in the war power area, so I think that could be an interesting one, particularly when you get into bills that, which I think Congress has Article I power to determine when someone leaves Iraq and comes back home, how long they have to stay before they're returned on their next assignment, and what sort of training that they need to do guerrilla warfare and a whole lot of other stuff. Now, how much of that can be done purely through congressional powers and how much it wants to get information from the executive branch to bolster that? But also in the last 6 years, there have been very experienced people like Henry Waxman and others who are pretty primed to do in-depth investigations, and their staff is very well primed. And they have to pick their targets. Otherwise, they don't have much time to accomplish much in the next year and a half.
I think it's a matter of policy, Congress should be hesitant to investigate the past as much as to inquire into the bases for present policies and operations. That it's always tempting, and I suppose, especially if you haven't had the subpoena power for 6 years of a presidential administration, to go back. But I do think that, again, opposition on the merits of current policies is the better approach. And I do think this reached its apex or nadir, both in terms of the journalistic community and the Congress. At one point, the Los Angeles Times had an 8-person bureau in Little Rock looking into what had happened when someone was governor. And I wonder if we'd had the same mentality in 1945, 46, 47, when Harry Truman became president. The idea that we would have spent all of our time tying down the Truman White House, finding out exactly what his relationship was to the Pendergast, somewhat heard corrupt political machine back in Missouri, instead of letting Truman rise to the occasion and lead the lead the efforts in the Cold War. That careful scrutiny of how one is using presidential power is appropriate, but going back into the past is distracting from the business of government.
I certainly agree with Walter that a focus on the past is destructive of government and is likely to be the area where you're going to have these kind of executive privilege clashes most likely. If you are actually having a clash about policy or about prospective lawmaking, then the likelihood that the executive branch is even going to have an issue over which they would assert executive privilege is much reduced.
Yeah.
That said, I think that the politics of the day, for better or for worse, are such that Iraq, writ large, how we got there, even though that's been investigated forever, how it's been conducted, the expenditure of money in Iraq,
It's just too tempting a political target, and I think we will see a lot of that.
You know, a very fine way to draw the line, in my view, would be between not investigating what actually happened with the Whitewater deal, but investigating whether a heads-up about a current Resolution Trust Corporation was inappropriately given in the administration. That strikes me as on the right side of the line of something that is, you know, a justifiable concern, if that distinction makes, you know, any difference.
Well, with the remaining time that we have, I'd be happy to take your questions. There's a microphone that we made available, so raise your hand, please, if you do have a question. And please keep your question as concise as possible. In the back.
I hope it's fair to ask you the question, Ed.
Yes, it is. We all vote yes, four to one.
Thank you, guys. The consensus of the panel is that the deck is stacked against the executive branch, an observation I've made in my career. So I'm very intrigued by your suggestion that the word oversight is the wrong word, and I'm prepared to abandon it. What's a better word?
Good question.
Well, that is a tough question. I've been thinking about that some. I think the word investigative would be better, but I think the executive branch probably resists that because that sounds like there's something to hide, though I think that is actually a more accurate term. I suppose legislative investigative is possible, too, but I think you're up to 9 syllables there, so I can see how oversight has an advantage there. Fact-finding would be another possibility. What's most important, though, is that members of Congress, who, as Lou indicated, may be confused about their constitutional responsibilities in some respects, not also be confused about their constitutional responsibilities in this respect. They do not have some sort of general supervisory oversight authority. Now, maybe, Lou, it amounts to exactly the same thing if they think about possible legislation or even, again, I'm not suggesting you need to have legislation pending, but they ought to understand that they're legislators. They're not supervisors of the executive branch.
Let me give you an analogy that makes it clear to me what the proper, quote, oversight role of Congress is and isn't. I argued Raines versus Byrd as acting Solicitor General, which was a suit challenging the exercise of a line item veto. And that suit was brought by two members of Congress, Senator Moynihan and Senator Byrd, who had not been denied any government benefit that had been line item vetoed by the president. That is, they weren't a hog farmer that didn't get the hog because the president line item vetoed it. They asserted that they had an interest, a legally cognizable interest, because as members of Congress, they had an interest in how the laws they had enacted were being implemented by the president. I thought that, I've always thought that was clearly wrong, that it is not their interest to, as legislators who voted for a law, having any interest different from a citizen, their job is over at that point, and that it has deleterious effects to get into the mindset that Congress can keep with the problem and deal with the execution of it. And we actually prevailed in that line item case 7-2. The court rejected the idea that members of Congress had a legally cognizable interest in the manner in which legislation was carried out. And I think that's correct. And it's one way to, I think, understand. I believe that's consistent with your position.
Absolutely.
Ed.
Lou?
Yeah, oversight as a word has a lot of problems. As you know, it often means overlook, and many people think that's what Congress has been doing for a long time. But I think if you are an authorizing committee and you put a program in motion, you have every right to see if the agency is complying with the law. It might be very vague, but maybe the agency is doing good things, and they've learned about problems that you couldn't anticipate when you first passed the statute, and you have to find out what's going on in order to improve the law. So I don't think there's – I think Walter did in the Bowser case. I think Chief Justice Berger said something that once
Congress passes legislation, its participation ends, and I don't think anyone in town could believe that. It's not the way Congress
It's a fine line, Lou, because Congress has a legitimate interest in whether additional legislation is necessary, legitimate interest in deciding, for example, whether appropriations ought to be sent to a different agency of government because the present agency turns out not to be an effective agency for doing it. So that there, it is an issue of double effect. There's almost always a verbal formulation that can be placed in terms of any congressional investigation in terms of the need for future legislation. And it's only in your heart of hearts that you would actually know whether you're legitimately seeking information you need for future legislation or whether you're trying to cross over the border and work on the executive execution of the law itself.
But it may not be only in your heart of hearts. It may be in the accommodation process as the executive branch tries to figure out what will actually serve your legitimate interests, so that can be sorted out, I think. Any other questions? Please raise your hand and the microphone will be brought to you. Well, seeing none, let me ask another question then. We've had some discussions about why the accommodation process so often works, and I think there's a consensus that it so often works because the executive branch almost always sees a political imperative to cave. But I wonder also if we could discuss some of the incentives that Congress has to get less than it was asking for in the first place. I think, for example, if Congress really wanted push to come to shove, it's going to probably take years to go through the litigation to get these documents. Now, maybe the answer to that is the political cost to the executive are so great during that time that that's not a meaningful constraint. But does anyone have any further thoughts on why we seem so often to come to some sort of agreement?
I think Congress relents because when push comes to shove, they lose. When the Attorney General has advised the President that in his or her view, the assertion of executive privilege is well taken, and the President makes a timely assertion on the basis of the opinion of the Attorney General, then if Congress sees this all the way through, the committee recommends to Congress that the full Congress issue a subpoena, and that when the President refuses to comply with it after voted by the full chamber, that the matter is then referred by Congress to a U.S. attorney with a notification by Congress that, in their view, this violates the criminal statute of being in contempt of Congress and is referred for prosecution. The U.S. attorney then looks to the opinion issued by the Attorney General of the United States, which said that the assertion of executive privilege was well taken. That's binding on the U.S. attorney, and no prosecution is forthcoming. That's also, as Ed said, several years down the road, when the controversy has long since passed, that we have come to that point. But I think if you ever brought this issue to the United States Supreme Court, you need only remind the court, if someone says, oh, this is not in the Constitution, the executive privilege. Well, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that a committee of Congress cannot subpoena the justices for all notes, all records, all law clerk memoranda, all internal drafts of everything having to pertain to the decision in, take your pick, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, Bush versus Gore, name your opinion. You would like to see all of the internal things and ask the court whether they think that would affect the way in which the court goes about exercising the judicial power of the United States, and to see why they win. The reason I think the president gives up, on the other hand, why we don't, is that Congress has, of course, you usually only get this when Congress is in the hands of another political party, and they can always cut appropriations for the function in question, decline to process the nominee. Congress has enormous power to say, if you're not going to give us documents about the conduct of the so-and-so office, we think we're not comfortable funding it at any level. So I think at the end of the day, that's what's on the other side.
I think there are actually three factors why Congress has an interest in compromising. Number one, as Ed mentioned, is delay. Often investigatory committees have a wrap-up date. That was true of the Senate Whitewater Committee. And so if Congress was to persist in seeking a full range of documents rather than accepting a smaller set of them, that fight may go beyond the life of the committee. Second, there's always the risk that if you did take it to court, you would get precedent adverse to you that you'd have to live with in the future. And third is that the executive, having possession of the actual documents, is in a position to say, well, this is what you really need. You know, you've issued this broad request. 90% of this you don't want. It's not helpful to you. It's overly broad. But here, we can give you this small set of documents or let you come and look at them and not actually get copies. And often that serves the Congress's purpose.
So, several panelists talked about the pressures in the White House that look like you're stonewalling and sort of cave. Being in Congress all these years, I see almost the opposite. Very, very few members have much interest in oversight. They find it really boring and time-consuming, and you don't get anywhere except year after year after year. I came in 1970 when a lot of the staffers stayed there for their career, 20, 25 years, and now there's much more turnover. So the incentive in Congress to do oversight is not very, very high.
Well, I think that Congress perhaps practices a little bit of job specialization here. You only need one or two. You only need Chairman Burton or Chairman Waxman to do a lot of oversight for Congress as an institution. And they are able, as Chris described, to really tie the executive branch up. But also I agree with Walter that if the administration thinks that they are in a strong position politically, that as a matter of technical legal process, they can run out the string and win. And, Ed, you know, your comments were that everyone thought that the accommodation process usually ended up in caving. I'm not sure that's the way to think about it. I think the accommodation process often ends up, as you mentioned, that Congress says, here is our legislative interest. That legislative interest is satisfied in a way that the executive branch is comfortable with, and people just go on. And, in fact, I think that is much the most common way that these things get handled. They never get into the paper. It's just dealt with. But I think if you have an administration that believes they're on politically strong ground, that they think they can explain why they're doing, that they think the accommodation process has gone well enough that they can demonstrate that they're not covering up, the executive branch can win.
Well, on that note, please join me in thanking the panelists.
I'm glad the last word.